Hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the vivacious voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello there.
How are you, Rich?
Devilishly well.
I love these little intros. They're getting better and better and better, to quote the great John Motson. Straight into some correspondence this week, mate. We've had an email from a Jonathan Grattan, and it's quite appropriate because it's all about cup keepers. He has said, or asked for that matter, what is the real point in having cup keepers? Isn't it more detrimental to the team playing an out-of-practice number two in important cup games rather than a trusted number one and your de facto best keeper?
It's a really good question. It's an interesting point. I think there's a few things at play here. What I do find interesting is when you get a goalkeeper that comes in that's very different to the goalkeeper that you'd ordinarily play. So a good example would be Patricio and Ruddy. You know, I would argue they're quite different types of goalkeepers, not necessarily right and wrong, better or worse, but just different in how they play. So then when you are bringing in a goalkeeper that is a different type of goalkeeper, it can then be different for the defence in front of them, the midfield. And you sometimes see that it's not quite as cohesive straight away because they're, you know, you often see it, even goalkeepers that might be left footed and then the next one's right footed, and how that can then change a defence and how they play. What I do find, though, and this is where the positive comes, is that if you're a sub-goalkeeper and you know you're the cup goalkeeper, then you will almost train looking forward to those games and you will be so motivated for those games knowing that that is your opportunity. Whereas it does often happen, and we've seen it with the mindset of a lot of, not necessarily goalkeepers, but teams where they don't take the FA Cup quite so seriously, where sometimes it can almost be seen as a bit of a drag. And I don't think it should be, by the way. We could go into a whole conversation here about the FA Cup and our love of the FA Cup. But it happened to an extent. You know, I saw it certainly at Brentford where you'd have like a JPT game. Use that as an example. And sometimes if you knew you weren't playing in the JPT game, you would set your mind as to, right, I've got a league game, then there's a JPT, and then my next game is the next league game. And you would then be motivated by the fact that you were the league goalkeeper. Similarly, whoever was the JPT goalkeeper or the cup goalkeeper, there's a real motivation knowing that that's my competition. I want to win that. And we've seen it with Gomez. Gomez was brilliant for Watford. You know, 38 years old, still throwing himself about like a 20-year-old, still playing at the absolute top of his game. And you can see just how driven he is by the fact that he's being given these games.
Okay, well, thanks for that question, Jonathan Grattan. If you would like to have your question answered on the podcast, it's very easy to get it to us on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official, on Facebook, just search GK Union, or send us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. Okay, this week's guest is a goalkeeper currently plying his trade between the sticks for Stoke City. He burst on the scene with 9 clean sheets in his first 15 games as a professional on loan at Cheltenham. And at the age of 19 years and 158 days, he became the youngest goalkeeper to ever make a senior appearance for England. He's also been selected in squads for his country in 2 major tournaments, the most recent of those being the 2018 World Cup in Russia. Jack Butland, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Thank you. Pleasure to be involved.
Well, we shall start with the current campaign. An interesting one for Stoke, back in the Championship. A change of manager from Paul Lambert at the back end of last season to Gary Rowett and now Nathan Jones. How's it gone for you on a personal level this season?
It's been an interesting one. It's been tough in terms of a lot of managerial changes. Obviously, expectations around the club. It's been a difficult one. One that's been important to try and keep a level head, to try and keep giving my best for the team as well as I can and try and have a calming influence if possible with kind of everything that's gone on. So on that side it's been tricky, but I've just tried to remain focused on doing my job to the best of my ability, and it's kind of the nice thing about being a keeper is you're on your own in a sense, and if you do your job you can have a positive impact on the team. So I've been trying to be as focused as I can on doing my bit, and I'm trying to help everyone else around me.
A mixed weekend for you as well. There was the draw against Ipswich, and of course Oklahoma City Thunder lost to the Pelicans, mate. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I know. It's like my NFL team as well. I'm not sure why I pick them. They have a good regular season and then it all goes tits up towards the end, excuse my language.
Well, it's an interesting one, this, because we had Asmir Begovic on the show previously, an ex-teammate of yours, of course. He's a massive sports fan, as I'm sure you know, and you are sports in particular. And it's not just that. He's got other interests like the clothing brand. And he also does a podcast. Now, he said it was a useful tool for him to escape football occasionally. And I guess for you, you've got your golf, your rugby. I even saw on Twitter, I think, a spot of slalom kayaking or something that you'd mentioned before. You had the great time on Question of Sport I've seen with you answering so many questions. You're quite big on other sports, aren't you?
I do love my sports. Even football didn't really take off on its own till a later date. I was doing everything when I was younger. Yes, it was the first sport I kind of took up, if you like, but joining secondary school and even, you know, primary schools and things like that, I was always a part of every team, always wanted to be involved in sport, everything from football to badminton to tiddlywinks, whatever it was. It was always ultra competitive and I just loved playing sport, and I've always had that kind of desire to be involved in other sports, watch it, loved playing them all so much when I was younger. So to have that release from football, because we all know it can be a very stressful environment sometimes, and it's nice to have a release from that. You know, you've got your family and your friends and things like that, but it's nice to have other focuses, other things you can kind of turn your mind to and get away from the stresses of it sometimes.
I read somewhere that you were a very good rugby player. At what age did you decide that it was definitely going to be goalkeeping that you went into?
Well, it all happened extremely quickly, really. Getting into the latter stages of secondary school, back home in Clevedon, I was playing rugby for my age group and the year above. We had tennis teams, football teams, cricket, everything. And I was playing outside of school. I was playing for a development team at the time. You might remember the player Jamie Shaw. He had a soccer school, which I was a part of. We ended up playing against a range of teams from across the country. We ended up playing against Arsenal, their academy teams, and ended up playing against Birmingham's academy team, West Brom. And just like that, it went from 1 week I was a part of all the different teams at school, and the next minute I had trials at West Brom and Birmingham. And before I even got to the West Brom trial, I'd done 3 weeks at Birmingham, and they'd offered me to come in full time. And it all happened very quickly. I was 14 at the time. There was a massive focus from not a lot of pressure from Birmingham to give up everything at school. I ended up breaking a thumb playing rugby for the school team, and that was when Birmingham did step in then and said, right, you know, school activities are going to have to stop now. And that was that. So it was almost, it was a bit of a whirlwind. It happened extremely quickly. Obviously, football was always my first love, if you like. And it just happened that quick. And from that trial, within 6 months, where I was playing in the Victory Shield for England against Ireland. So it was almost, there was no need for me to even think about it. It just kind of happened. And I was very lucky that those opportunities kind of came around that quick. But that was as quick as that came around. It was as quick as, unfortunately, all the other sports had to stop at the same time. So it happened fairly quick.
That seems to be a common theme now. In fact, I had a similar thing myself, that I played for a couple of different school teams, and 14, 15, that seems to be the age where a lot of academies step in and say, right, you need to make a choice now. But it must have happened so quickly for you. The fact that you joined a little bit later than a lot of lads do, certainly, yeah. We see lads now joining 8, 9, 10 years old, so a little bit later. But I remember having a talk with, it was Martin Thomas, and you must have only been 15, 16 at the time. And I remember him telling me, this is the guy you've got to look out for. So it must have all happened very, very quickly.
Yeah, it did. I was very lucky to have some great coaches. You know, when I got into Birmingham, I was very quickly introduced to Dave Watson at the time, who we had, Mike Taylor, and over the years, Joe Hart, Ben Foster, those kind of guys on loan. So I was very lucky in the sense that I was given the opportunity both by Birmingham and my school to allow me to train days with them. I've been, you know, quite a good blank canvas, whether it be teaching myself new things or picking up things. I've always felt I've adapted and learned stuff quite quickly, whether it be golf or whatever. Or obviously, when it came to getting some real goalkeeping coaching, I loved doing it. But, you know, to get that coaching as well, I felt like I was able to pick it up fairly quick. And I think that's what benefited me that quickly, was just the fact that I think I was good size. I never had any massive growth spurts. I was just always constantly bigger than everyone, which I think worked in my favour as well. And just managed to take it all on board quite well, and very lucky to have the coaches around me that I did, and got me off to a very good start.
Certainly while you were there, the pathway that you've had since then, the fact that they were open to allowing you to go on loans, and of course you went on, yeah, a few. I want to talk to you about Cheltenham in particular, and actually a comment that you touched, yeah, on at the start of the podcast about the role of a goalkeeper, the fact that whether you're playing in the Premier League or you're playing in League Two, your job effectively doesn't change. If anything, I've always made an, yeah, argument that the lower down you play, often it can be even more difficult for a goalkeeper, given that you're having to deal with the elements. The stadium obviously isn't maybe necessarily quite so big. The pitch isn't as good. The style of football might mean that you're dealing with more aerial balls, potentially more through balls. How did you find that experience going to Cheltenham at such a young age?
I agree with you there. No one's saying that playing in the Champions League is easy, but I agree with, as a goalkeeper, you're decision making is the same throughout. Yes, you might be up against more clinical strikers, but you certainly have to deal with I'd say, tougher scenarios to a certain extent. So I'd agree with that. But Cheltenham, for me, was, I look back at it now as being probably the biggest loan move or most important stage of my career, if you like. I'd come through all the academy stuff. I'd been fortunate enough to be involved with England. But being able to go out on loan at a young age and experience that, experience a professional dressing room, experience the crowd that you don't get playing for Birmingham under-18s on a weekend, experience the car schools travelling to and from away games and things like that, those kind of experiences, I feel, with young players, especially at the minute, and keepers to a certain extent, are so important that you get those experiences. Because there's a lot of players now and young keepers that I'm seeing, they get into early 20s and have got only a handful of league games to their name. They haven't got the experience of being involved in big games and in front of crowds. And that's what I felt was a massive part of me maturing as a person, going through those experiences, having those games, making mistakes, and having to bounce back 3 days later, midweek, away to Southend or whatever it was. You've got to experience that to improve. And I think that was, you know, a testament to the club. And I thank Cheltenham and Mark Yates, who was the manager at the time, Steve Book, the goalie coach, for giving me that opportunity, because I feel it was a massive turning point and platform for me to build my career on.
Something that seems apparent in your career is that you've always been keen to be a number one, keen to be playing. And obviously you moved to Stoke, yeah. You then went out on loan to several different clubs in order to continue playing. Yeah. But am I right in thinking, even choosing Stoke, you had the opportunity to go maybe to bigger clubs, but you chose Stoke given the fact that you knew at some point your chance would definitely come?
Yeah, I always had and always will do have belief in my ability. And at the time, I was 19. I had loved my time at Birmingham. Unfortunately, there was a period where things weren't stable with the club and a lot of young players were under pressure. And it was difficult in terms of financially, the club weren't stable and felt it was right to move on and did have options. But I felt Stoke was somewhere and a big part of the move as well was management, was the goalie coach I'd be working with. And it was very much the next step. How do I progress my career? Of course, at 19, you're young, you're full of confidence. I was thinking I was going to go there and in 6 months I'd be in the team. And you know, I was naive to think that the Premier League was another level up that I wasn't ready for at that time. And I knew that I had to go out and play games still to stay in the manager's eye, to keep on with international, to keep progressing. I knew I needed to play. And thankfully, the club bought into that. And we'd organised loan moves where I was able to still come back and train a couple of days with Andy at Stoke and the rest of the keepers, which felt was important. And again, was able to continue playing games and improving until the point that I could go back to Stoke. And, you know, I was in a position where I could say to Sparky, look, I want to play. When can I get a chance? When can I get a chance? And if you're not playing, I don't believe you have the right to do that. Unless there's injuries that open up in front of you, I feel like you need to stake your claim by playing enough games, and that's always been a major factor of my pathway, if you like, and I need to keep playing.
You just mentioned something really interesting to me there about one of the reasons you chose Stoke was the goalkeeper coach, and I've got to know Andy Quay because I've been to several seminars now and listened to him talk, and he's a very intelligent individual, very forward-thinking goalkeeper coach. But it's something that for a lot of our listeners, we get a lot of goalkeeper coaches listening, a lot of young goalkeepers listening, they don't fully appreciate how important that is to the development. The fact that it's not just about serving footballs at a goalkeeper, it's everything from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep and everything in between, whether it be nutritional, whether it be the technical side, the physical side, the mental side. How much of an impact has Andy had on your career?
Massive. I've been very lucky, as I mentioned before, from a young age, from 14 to 19, having Dave Watson, and then from that being with Andy for such a long period of time as well. It's been really and really important. Andy's been brilliant. And you touched on everything there. Being a goalie coach is a lot more than serving balls. It's a week for us consists of conversations about making sure that we're getting the right preparation going into a game, whether it be the team we're facing on the weekend, who are we up against, what are their strengths, how are they going to affect the goal? Are we going to be dealing with more crosses? Are they getting to the byline? Do they have certain players that shoot from distance more, you know, free kick specialists, you know, everything that we're up against on that weekend we cover throughout the week. If we're fortunate to not have a midweek game, then you start to look, okay, how much better can we get physically? Everything that we do in the gym is not with the fitness coach, it with Andy and the fitness coach. Everything is goalkeeping related. How can we be more powerful in the gym to create better reactions outside? How can we get an extra couple of centimetres off the floor when we're making saves, catching crosses? And I think to progress as a goalkeeper in the modern day, that's massively important. The focus on distribution nowadays, okay, it's now a massive part of the game, not just keeping the ball out of the net, but how can we be prepared for what we're going to face defensively from the opposition? Where are our targets going to be? Do they press high? Are the fullbacks going to be on? So everything we do on a weekly basis covers all of those things, so that ultimately when you go into the game on the weekend, you feel sharp, you feel comfortable, and everything then becomes a decision and second nature, if you like. You've covered it, and if you're in a good mental space going into the game, everything has been worked on and has given you a platform to perform on a weekend.
Something we haven't actually discussed that much on this podcast, believe it or not, is injury. It's nearly 3 years ago now since you suffered the fractured ankle against Germany while playing for England. It was a long road to recovery, one that was documented in that really good documentary where you were really open and you talked through the processes that you went through. Talk us through that, both from a physical and a mental perspective for you that time.
Physical was the easiest bit. It took so long for one main reason. First operation, I had three, basically it was a stress fracture, fairly nasty one, but I ended up needing three screws to secure it and things like that. And I ended up getting fit for the following pre-season. So that was the end of March, I broke it. I had an operation a couple of days later and I worked all through the summer and I was fit for pre-season, only to have issues again, which took another 6 months to diagnose as the initial one not healing properly because of screws being put in the wrong place. So physically, my body healed, reacted really well, but with stress fractures, they don't heal particularly as well as a fresh break. So the importance of those screws being in the right place was massive. And it wasn't until, as I said, 6 months down the line where I needed a fresh pair of eyes to look at it. He said, well, it's still broken because of the position of the screws. Immediately had another operation, fixed it, and here we are. So the most difficult thing was the mental aspect. Physically, I've always been, you know, touch wood, been good with injuries, muscle injuries. Everyone breaks their fingers and stuff as a keeper. It happens, but I've always been a good healer. So physically, it wasn't a problem. Mentally was the tough one because the timing of the injury initially was terrific because I felt like I was in a position where I could potentially challenge Joe at the time. I saw that England game against Germany as a bit of an audition, if you like, a bit of a pre-tournament audition to hopefully go and challenge for the number one spot for England. So to then miss out on the whole of the European Championships and then ultimately the whole of the next season, watching your teammates training outside the physio room, all of that. Mentally, it was the hardest thing because I'd never not been able to play what I loved or play sport or be competitive for that period of time before. So mentally was the tough one.
That season in particular, I remember it just felt like you were being highlighted on Match of the Day every week. I remember the save I think you made away at Norwich that sticks in my mind, which was a phenomenal one down to your right-hand side. But it just felt like things were going from strength to strength. And you mentioned that about a clean break, and I guess where I can relate, for all the injuries I had, and I had a broken arm, you kind of knew when it was going to heal. A clean break, and it's a case of X amount of months, and you will be fit. Whereas I had, say, an injury, a shoulder injury, where it could have been 2 months, or it could have been a year. And it was one where, mentally, I couldn't get my head around that. However, I certainly came back stronger once I was fit. Is that the case for you now? Do you feel mentally a lot stronger now than you did pre-injury?
Definitely. As you mentioned, everything up until that point, it was just on the up. So that was the first time I'd really been knocked back, the first time anything had really gone wrong, if you like. And in the end, it was 16 months in the end until I was fully fit, 15 months. And like you said, it was the unknown. It was that period between the last operation where we got it right, where you wake up one morning, it feels good. The next morning, it couldn't feel any worse. And just that unknown was the most difficult thing. But ultimately, I feel I've been through it now. I've missed out on tournaments I never wanted to. I thought I was going to be and hoped to be a part of and completely missed them. Missed so many games for Stoke, so many chances. And yeah, I was on the up and it just completely stopped. So I certainly feel now that I'm much stronger. I'm much more in control of my emotions in terms of taking the rough with the smooth, staying calm, especially as a keeper. It's the most important thing. I wish I hadn't missed as long with the injury, but ultimately, I feel like I've come out the other side a more mature keeper, and hopefully now I've got the best years ahead of me.
We mentioned England there, and we mentioned the stat at the top of the show, the youngest goalkeeper to ever play for England for the senior side. The thing for it was a 124-year record as well, which was quite a phenomenal record to break. The thing for me that sticks out with that stat is that you hadn't actually played a first-team game for Birmingham, your current club, right?
No, that was right. I'd come off the back of two loan spells with Cheltenham, going to the Under-20 World Cup and being on standby at that point. And then Stuart Pearce basically putting me forward. I ended up going away with the team to Poland and Ukraine for the Euros. And then the next friendly after that was Italy away in Switzerland, which was strange enough, but the opportunity was there. And it was just all off the back of a couple of loan spells at Cheltenham. And Stuart Pearce, who was manager of that under-20 team in Colombia, kind of gave me that recommendation, if you like. And if there is an injury or whatever, that Jack would be able to go for experience. And it was that that set me on the way to that. That's the stat that people tend to pick up on now, as I hadn't played there. A league game for Birmingham, or outside of League Two by that point.
And that relationship, obviously, with Stuart Pearce is what took you to the Olympics in 2012. Talk us through that experience, because it was a funny old time with the Great Britain team, and some people were in favour of it, some people weren't, but you were given special dispensation, I believe, to play because you'd gone to 2012 but not actually played in the tournament.
Yeah, I'm very thankful for that, because, again, it was another incredible experience, and one that, okay, not many players will be able to say they can experience again as a member of the Team GB football team and represent an Olympics. For me, as we've mentioned, you know, loving all sports and being a big part of things like that, to be around that was incredible. We only managed to spend 4 or 5 days around the Olympic Village, but, you know, a big basketball fan, and Kobe was there, LeBron. Bumped into all those guys. They're a lot bigger than me as well, so they kind of bumped off them, but just seeing all that Usain Bolt, all those kind of guys around, it was an incredible experience. And for once, football, we were just really the outsiders. Everyone was kind of, well, footballers are here kind of thing. Mm. We weren't the biggest team there. We weren't the most important people. I know that sounds a bit arrogant, but it's true, because you don't go to many tournaments, you don't go to many games where you're not the team that people are talking about. It was really interesting. It was an incredible experience, and one that I'll always remember, but really glad to be a part of it. And something that I will always remember.
There is one great image, actually, and we put this out on our Twitter, and that we saw of you in the penalty shootout with South Korea. I think you were adopting tactics, shall we say, to put off the taker, but you stuck your tongue out in a sort of crazy pose, and your tongue was bright blue.
Yeah.
Had you been drinking too much Powerade or something?
It was exactly that. And funnily enough, the Under-20 World Cup in Colombia was the first time this happened. I actually did save a penalty then, so it worked then. But it didn't work in the Olympics, unfortunately. I think it was the best penalties I've ever faced.
Really?
And I think everyone was top quarter of the goal in the top corner. And that was our kind of Olympic dream over, unfortunately. Yeah, it was Powerade a couple of years before in the Under-20 World Cup. And again, I didn't know. I'd just been drinking Powerade, and family and friends were watching it on, I think it was Eurosport at the time, and noticed it. So completely unintentional, but it didn't work, unfortunately.
Fast forward to probably this time last year, and it's something I'm really keen to talk to you about and get your perspective now. But I remember, in fact, being on a radio station this time last year, and the big debate was, of course, Butland or Pickford. And it seemed like it was neck and neck. You know, you were both playing alternate games almost. It was as good as 50-50. Didn't really know who Gareth Southgate was going to go with. And of course, he chose Jordan Pickford. Just keen to know how he broke the news to you, how you felt about how you've dealt with it since.
You think about it and you focus on it and you work all season towards it. So there's never an easy way to hear it or take it. You know, I had a conversation with the manager, and he kind of broke the news to me then. It was around the media day when kind of everything was, squad numbers are being released and everything like that. Obviously disappointed at something I'd always worked forward to. But in the time that Gareth was manager, we made a conscious effort that we were going to be the difference makers. We were going to be the team that kind of puts things right, if you like, and were the ones that were going to try and be successful. In the past, a lot has been said about us not achieving and all those kind of things. And we looked at everything. We looked at all the different things that were going to make us successful. And it was going to take a squad. So it was difficult to take. I've been in positions before when I was younger where I wasn't the number one going into a tournament, or I was the number one going into a tournament. And you learn to appreciate the roles that you have to take as a goalkeeper. Barring an injury or anything spectacular, it was going to be unlikely that I was going to feature in the World Cup. However, I had to be ready. I had to be on my game and making sure that I was showing Jordan the respect by being as good as I could be and pushing him to the best that he could be as well. So you've got to be humble. You've got to kind of suck it up and get on with it, because keepers, you're part of a small group. But when you're part of a small group, if you've got someone that's not pulling their weight or someone that's disrupting it, it's a lot more disrupting than anything else. So disappointed not to get the call, but I'm still young. I'm still 25. I've still got a lot in me. And it's fuel for the fire. But at that moment, I knew that I had a different role I had to take up. And that was to be ready if needed, but to make sure that Jordan was prepared as possible. And thankfully, he was. And Jordan and the rest of the team, and we're all part of it, went on to a successful World Cup, which hopefully we can all now as a squad build on.
It's really interesting to hear you say that, because obviously a lot has been said about the unity within the camp, but looking closer at the goalkeepers, it really felt like there was a real togetherness between you and Jordan Pickford and Nick Pope. And there was a moment just before the penalty shootout with Colombia, I was watching closely, and there was a moment where Jordan Pickford stepped away from the group and almost, it seemed like he buried his head in your chest, shall we say, and you sort of put your arms around him and said a few words in his ears. Now, I don't know whether you want to say it, but is there any way you could give us an insight as to what you were saying to Jordan in that moment before he went to the shootout?
We'd already gone over everything, and that was another big key of the World Cup. Everything was covered before every game between the keepers, Martin Muggs and the goalie coach, the analysts. We'd go through everything that we'd need to go through. We'd all make our individual decisions on where we thought penalties would go, and we'd come to a collective answer. And that was good for me and Nick as well. That felt like we had an input. So that was nice from our point of view that we were part of that process. But in that moment, we'd done the hard work. Jordan's a very positive character. He's got a lot of aggression in him, which is great, and he's got that desire. Really, it was just reminding him of all that. I can't remember the exact words I said to him, but we knew that in that moment, when there's so much going on, usually you've got outfielders wanting to come over and you say, you know, trying to tell you, I'm not going to dive out the way on purpose, you know. So sometimes you don't need them near you. Sometimes you just need to come away from it. And we had decided on that as keepers, that we'd come away and have our little moment before going in and not swamp him. And ultimately he went and made the save that got us through. So it felt great from mine and Nick's point of view to be a part of that process, and like to think that we helped Jordan as well in the process and ultimately make the save.
And speaking about the situation now and touching on, I guess, what's happened with you since then, in that obviously Stoke going down to the Championship. And from my point of view, it feels like it's almost one step backwards, hopefully for two steps forward. When that all happened, the World Cup and then coming down into the Championship, was it a case for you then to reassess, set some new goals and go again? Have you got in your mind what the next step is for you in regards to both England and your domestic career?
I'm not stupid. I know the scenario that I'm currently in. I know that to challenge for the England shirt, I need to be in the Premier League and competing at a high level. I may still be able to compete in the England squad to be able to compete for the jersey. I know that I've got to perform at a high level in the Championship to stay in that squad. I know what it's going to take to now get back there and compete. So for me, it was a frustrating summer, a difficult one, but ultimately now I have a job on my hands to get back to where I want to be. And the goal all season long is to get back promoted with Stoke. It's been a tough season and there's still 12 games to go. There's still an opportunity for us to be an outsider and creep back into those playoffs, which is ultimately the goal, you know. But beyond that, it's difficult to say at the minute. I know that I want to, and I know that I'm capable of competing at the highest level, and that's always been the target for me. I go out every week, every day in training. I try and be the best I can, and that will take me to where hopefully I can get to. But in the short term, it's now 12 games to go, as I said, and try and get into those playoffs and back into the Premier League with Stoke. Beyond that, it's still important for me to be playing in the Premier League to progress my career as in general, but ultimately in the England squad as well, which is a massive part of me and my career. As I've loved being a part of that and want that to continue.
A massive part of football as well is social media. That disconnect between players and fans is gradually becoming less of a thing, it seems, with Twitter and Instagram and all the other platforms out there. You're quite big on social media, aren't you? Do you see it as an enjoyable aspect of being a footballer?
Yes and no. It's a difficult one, social media. It's such a great tool for so many things, but I'm so emotional when it comes to games sometimes. The last thing I want to do is be putting out a post, because I know if I was a fan and we'd lost or what have you, and you see a post out from the players there, the usual captions, I think it would wind me up. So I'm one of those. It's my best friend at times, and also it can be your enemy. But I think it's important. I think it's important that it's used in the right way. It's important that fans get that interaction. It's important from a player's perspective to grow their brand and to show what they're about, because a lot of the time you only see players from pitch side through the TV, over radio, podcasts, and you don't get to see what they're actually like outside of that. So I think it's an important tool if used properly. I try to do that, but it can also be a difficult place at times. But like I said, it's a great tool that if used properly is very beneficial to both the player and the fans.
It's the responses for me as well. That's what I always think about. You've got 187,000 followers as well, right? So you chuck out a post and there's a good chance, say 10% of those people respond to that post. I guess it's hard enough for you to think about posting and going through with the posting, but to then potentially look at the responses and get back to those responses. And then if you don't get back to the responses, some people get the ump.
Yeah, it's difficult. Twitter, I do employ and I do use a social media company, which I work very close with in terms of trying to put out the right messages, trying to interact when we can and give back. But I do try and give Twitter a yard sometimes, because it can be a nasty place. And that's the sad thing with it, is it can be a platform for good, but it can be also a platform for bad. So I do tend to give Twitter a little bit more distance. And the difficult thing with it is one tweet or opinion. It could be true, it could be false, but it's those difficult ones, that it's those false ones that gather the momentum, that it all of a sudden becomes a nasty place where you feel like you then have to speak up for no reason to kind of quash things and to even things out, which is a shame with it. But that's the nature of the beast. But it is a great tool. And that's why, you know, I use a social media company so I can take some of that stress away from me. But communicating with them, so everything is okayed by me, everything is run by me and things like that, because it's important how I'm perceived and what messages are getting across. But especially if the result isn't too good on the weekend, I do try and give it a little bit of extra distance.
Well, someone who was perceived in a great light by many a football fan all over the world was obviously Gordon Banks, who sadly passed away at the age of 81 this week. Now, you obviously had the Stoke connection with Gordon Banks.
Yeah.
And I guess, to an extent, could call him a friend.
I'm very lucky that that's the case. Very lucky to be associated with him through the club. And over the last 3 or 4 years, got to know him and meet him on many occasions. And that's an extremely proud memories for me, to be able to have shared time with him, conversations with him. You know, my mum raves about him all the time as well. And yeah, it's been incredible to have that contact. I can't say enough about him. I think over the last week or so, everyone has seen exactly what kind of person he was, because everyone that has spoke up has got exactly the same thing to say. And you know, I can't echo that anymore. He was an incredible person, extremely humble man, very positive man, and absolutely loved football. So to be able to share some conversations with him over the years and memories that I'll cherish, really, and feel very lucky to have had that opportunity.
And just those conversations, I'm interested to know how they went. Were there ever any disagreements between old goalkeeping and new goalkeeping and methods that were used then to now?
No disagreements, but we did, you know, there was comparisons. You know, we did compare things. You know, he was so keen to learn about the way things are done now. It was very difficult for me to get a word in edgeways the first time we met. Coming back to that, it was the first time I met him. We actually, it was Boxing Day before we played Man United at home, and I actually had to ask the manager, Sparky, Mark Hughes, obviously, if I could carry on chatting to him for an extra 5 minutes, because we had a team meeting coming up. But he just wanted to know so much about things now, and eventually got onto conversations about how things were for him back then. And, you know, we'd speak about Andy and the goalie coach and gym sessions. And he said, well, we didn't have a goalie coach back then and didn't have gyms or didn't have weights to use. So I had to strap sandbags to his shoulders and jump off curbs to do squats and things like that. So it was even more incredible to think about how good he was as a keeper with the resources he had when he was at Leicester, getting the youngsters over to take crosses at him, to take shots at him. You know, things have come on so far, but he was so keen to learn and to just talk about goalkeeping and football in general. He absolutely loved it. We had conversations about defending corners. He could never understand why people wouldn't have a man on the post at times. We had good conversations about, and in Gordon's day, it was man marking, a man on the post. Your man scores, it's his fault. So it was a lot simpler back then. You know, I'd tell him about how we do a three-man zone with a man on the edge, one goes short, this, that, and the other. And yeah, we had some good conversations about it, which was quite funny.
Just to chip in on that, and this is something I still find extraordinary, and obviously everyone talks about that save, but just to mention that save, bearing in mind how much football has progressed over the last 50 years, and I'll often watch, you know, they have the like classic games on, and you smile sometimes when you look at players that are a little bit overweight, or you see like George Best going around all these different players that seem so immobile. But even today, I would still class that as the greatest ever save, which is extraordinary, bearing in mind how much things have progressed physically, technically, and all else that has kicked on in the game. And yet, I don't think I've ever seen a better save than that, which is, what, a good 50 years ago now?
I'd have to agree. I really hope there isn't a poll, because it's just an opportunity for someone to vote the other way. But I think it should always be classed as the best ever. The nature of it, the fact that it was Pelé that headed it against Brazil, there was so much to it. And no matter how many times you watch it, to get that over the bar from where he makes contact with it is near enough impossible on its own, let alone the fact it was a header into the ground. He had to stop himself, then go again, near enough reach behind him, judge the pace of the ball off the ground, which I'm sure was difficult enough to read at the best of times. So to make that save was just pure skill, talent, and ultimately the decision making at first to hold the position and where to attack it, but pure talent and skill really, and every aspect and element of the save was as good as it could be. The fact it was for England against Brazil in a World Cup from Pelé, everything that goes with it, you know, every element was top draw.
Absolutely. And the last question I have to ask you, what is the biggest lesson that goalkeeping has taught you?
That is a tough one. Just resilience, because it can be a tough place, but it's also the best place as well. I absolutely love it. The opportunity to be the hero. People will always try and make you the enemy as well, but it would be resilience. Picking yourself back up, going again, it leads itself into all parts of life, and being able to take the rough with the smooth and shoulder all that yourself. Yeah, I'd say resilience.
Jack Butland, thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, that was Jack Butland. Thoroughly enjoyed that, mate.
Yeah, fantastic.
Resilience.
I love that. I mean, it's something, and there seems to be a theme. All these goalkeepers we're talking to, and how many say something along that line. And it's not just goalkeeping. How often do they talk about it? And it actually becomes so much more than that. That really, there are no goalkeepers in the world that go through a career where it just goes from good to great to incredible, and that upward curve, which Jack Butland had for such a long period of time. But we're now seeing the resilience that he has, that he's had a few things go against him, and he is still sticking in there and putting in good performances, very good performances, week in, week out for Stoke City now. And no doubt he will be back in the Premier League. But I just think it's a really nice lesson for everyone listening in to have that kind of mentality, whatever you do.
Keeper capers.
Well, the keeper capers this week is an interesting one. Rich, Motherwell versus Hearts in the Scottish Premiership. Colin Doyle, last minute. David Turnbull with what has been called a tame free kick. It looked to catch in the wind, bounced in front of Doyle and over his shoulder. I'm just going to read out some of what was said before you can analyse this situation. Chris Sutton was the co-commentator. Made a real mess of it, he said. All you can say is it's horrific from Doyle. Dreadful from Doyle. It's a schoolboy error. He doesn't judge the bounce. Thoughts?
Well, first and foremost, it's not the first negative thing Chris Sutton said about goalkeepers. An absolute keeper hater if there ever was one. So it doesn't surprise me that he's made such idiotic comments, I think it's fair to say. But look, it's an error, and he's held his hands up. It's an error. The bit that, if you watch the replay again and you watch it from behind, there is a lot of movement on the ball. The wind has played a part, and it's pitched just in front of him with a lot of spin. And he's misjudged it. He's misjudged it by probably half a foot. If he could have just got to the pitch of the ball, he would have been able to catch it on the bounce and pick it up. And he's ever so slightly gone too far across the goal. And it's minimal. But in the end, of course, it looks embarrassing. And he knows himself. He knows it is an error.
It's worth saying that Craig Levein said that Colin put his hands up to the rest of the lads and apologised for making the errors.
I do often think, and this isn't just this error, but a lot of errors can look a lot worse than they actually are. And this is one that, it's very obvious because it's a shot from distance and all eyes are on him. You know, and there was another good example that I'm sure we'll talk about involving Joe Day, and we'll talk about that shortly, where sometimes
errors can go and not be seen. A good example, for instance, and this often happens, is if the camera angle, this can often play a part as to whether someone sees it as an error or not. So for a lot of games where you might only have the cameras from one particular angle, if the shot is taken from the other side of the pitch, it might go through the goalkeeper, but you can't necessarily see it. Now, when you're playing a game like he was playing here, where you've got cameras behind the goal, you've got cameras everywhere, then of course it's going to be that much more obvious because there's going to be an angle where you see exactly what's happened. Unfortunately for him, he's moved too far across the goal. He's misjudged it slightly. There is a bit of wind. The pitch is very, very dry. And you can see that it's really kicked up off the turf with a bit of spin. And he's just misjudged it. And that's what you get. You get those kind of comments. And no one necessarily understands exactly why he's done what he's done. But essentially, we're talking probably, what, a foot? Not even that. But it costs you dearly.
And the free kick wasn't hard. I think this is part of the issue with this one. It wasn't like he's wrapped in a knuckleball or he's bent one into the top corner. It was a relatively tame free kick that bounced in front of the goalkeeper. To the uneducated eye, you would look at that. I would look at that straight away and go, he's had one there.
It's a misjudgment. What I would say, though, is you look at the free kick from behind, it has come in quite a distance. You know, there is obviously some wind there. It has come in quite a distance, but it is the bounce. If it doesn't bounce, he collects it very simply. It's the fact that it's bounced about a yard away from him. It is a dry pitch and it has kicked up off the turf. And again, we mentioned it. It's not like we're talking huge margins here. It's a matter of a few centimetres that he's misjudged this. But in the end, it's proved costly.
OK, moving on to the weekend's actions. You've mentioned Jode there that we'll come on to in a bit. But we're going to rewind a few days and go back to Monday night. Last Monday night, Wolves hosting Newcastle. Now, there was a lot of reaction to the incident at the end of the game between Willy Bolly and Martin Dubravka. Now, it was quite interesting from our perspective that on Twitter, we put it out and expected the customary goalkeepers union reaction. It was actually split. It was split by a lot of goalkeepers saying, no, he should have 100% been stronger there. He should have commanded his error. He should have punched. What are your thoughts on the incident?
Yes, he should have been stronger. No, he shouldn't have punched. Yes, it is a foul.
So no, he shouldn't have punched, because most people have said surely he should just tip that over the bar.
It's too far away from the bar. It's not underneath the bar. We're about a yard out from the goal. So there's a danger if you try and tip it over the bar. There's a danger if you try and punch it back into play, especially when the ball's coming down effectively vertically. You know, it's really high up in the air. It's coming down vertically. So it's not a natural one that you would punch. And of course, by punching it, it's going to go back into play, and there's a danger with that. You might try and help it on and push it out for a corner behind you. Again, there's a danger to that. But look, he could have been stronger. The simple thing is, the decision was right. The execution was poor. He could have been a lot stronger in his jump, but it was a foul. There's a picture, in fact, we tweeted a picture of an arm across the face, effectively, two arms across the face, which the basic point is that the ball has gone through his hands for the player to then head it in. So what I'm saying is that if there isn't that challenge, does Dubravka completely miss the ball? Of course he doesn't. He doesn't miss the ball. He sees it and he catches it 1,000 times out of 1,000. The only reason he hasn't caught that ball is the fact that there's a hand, two hands across him on his shoulders, and it's meant that the ball has gone through his hands before it's being headed into the net. So 100% it is a foul. And every referee that's looked at it has also said it's a foul. You can't argue with that. The bit that I do agree with is that he could have been stronger. There's, you know, I'm not saying that other goalkeepers wouldn't have made that catch, because other goalkeepers would have made that catch. He could have been stronger, but that does not take away from the fact that it was a foul.
And this is the point, right? For the whole argument that regardless of whether he should have punched it or regardless of whether he should have been stronger, at the end of the day, all of those factors are irrelevant because it was a foul.
It was a foul.
Right?
it's as simple as that. And I've had this conversation with too many people this week. That's why I get a bit irate, because, and actually by the end of each conversation, they're like, oh yeah, actually it was a foul. Of course it was a foul. But you're right. Yes, he could do better. Similarly, I try and give an example. One of the examples I gave would be a goalkeeper kicking the ball up to a striker. And how often do we see this? And then the defender will be climbing all over the striker and head the ball. And the referee, more often than not, will give the foul because it is a foul. Now, is that not to say that the striker couldn't have been a bit stronger? They could have maybe backed into the defender a bit, maybe jumped a bit higher and won the flick on. Yeah, they could have done all those things. But it's irrelevant because it's a foul.
You got that off your chest, didn't you, mate?
Thank you.
Felt like you needed to do that. Therapeutic.
Important, I think.
Moving on to Jode.
Yeah.
Big game for Newport, obviously hosting Man City in the FA Cup, and for a while kept them at bay. He was the man who had all the headlines in the previous round against Middlesbrough, because he obviously rushed off to see his newborn twins. Lovely story, that one. This one, not such a lovely story. An interesting game for him. I think we're going to focus on three goals, the first of which he received a bloody nose for. But there's been some reaction to it.
There has, and it's not been massively positive. And I felt a bit sorry for him, really, because it's not an error. It's a shot from 6 yards that's absolutely smashed, tried to get his hands up to it, couldn't react in time, it's hit him in the face, and it's ended up going in the goal. Now, when it hits him in the face, it could have gone anywhere, but the reason that commentators picked up and thought it was an error was the fact that it went over the goal line so softly, so meekly. But that doesn't make it an error. Ultimately, he's tried to get his hands to the ball, but it's struck at such pace from close distance. And if you look, his positioning's fine. The angle that he's got towards the post and where he is positioned in the area is absolutely fine. Everything he's done is spot on. On another day, it hits him on the face and goes over the bar or goes wide. Unfortunately for him, there's not a lot of control that you can get when it hits you in the nose. You've just got to hope for a little bit of luck. And he didn't get that luck. And it's only the fact that it's trickled over the goal line that quite a few people have said, oh, we should have done better. What I would say, he wasn't necessarily blamed all that much for the goals thereafter. Maybe the next one to an extent. I do wonder whether it might have affected his mindset slightly, because the second goal was more of an error. But again, the commentators didn't pick up on the fact that it was a dreadful pitch. You know, the Newport pitch really wasn't very good. And credit to Man City for playing as well as they did on that pitch. And that ball that was struck from Phil Foden, it struck from distance. It has pitched again just in front. He should probably do a little bit better, but it does make it difficult. And I'm sure a lot of goalkeepers listening in now that have played on fields that just, you know, aren't suitable for a game of football, that are dealing with balls that are bouncing just in front of you and the bobbles that they can take. You know, Tim Flowers knows all too well the classic one that bobbled over his head. Sometimes the pitch is going to play a part, and I don't think that was really taken into consideration, certainly with the second one that Jodea conceded. For me, the one that he would be really annoyed about was the one that beat him at the near post. And we've touched on it a lot on this show that getting beaten at your near post isn't necessarily an error. It doesn't make it an error. But I think in this case, it was just the fact that he misread it. As it struck, his hand seemed to go towards his face and then to his right-hand side to make the save. It just seemed like he's misjudged the initial strike. And in the end, it beats him quite easily at his near post.
Just that first one, I just want to quickly talk about that one again. Because is there anything else that he could have done differently? Because some people have suggested that maybe his hands weren't up quick enough. Now, there is also the argument that I saw someone state that if that was a Manuel Neuer or an Alisson or an Edison or name any top flight, top end goalkeeper, if it hits their face, it then goes over the bar. It doesn't drop down and go back into the goal.
Right, they've got a harder face, maybe. I mean, what could he have done differently? He could have maybe come and spread. Would that have been the right decision from there? Probably not. I think what he did percentage-wise, probability-wise, he would have given himself the best chance. It is purely just a case of reactions, which we go back to what we said previously about Dubravka. Am I saying that nobody saves that? No, of course. There's goalkeepers out there that have better reactions than Jodea. Maybe they make that save. Does David De Gea make it? Probably, because he's got incredible reactions. But it's not an error. I mean, he's taken a good position. He's done everything right, I would say. And unfortunately, he's just not quite reacted quick enough. But even that said, on another day, it might hit his face and go somewhere else. That's the bit you can't control. Do you know what? And if it goes through him, had he struck it and it not hit his face, let's say it had just gone, like the David Seaman one against Ryan Giggs, although one or two people did blame David Seaman for that. But do you know what? Had that have happened, it just hit the roof of the net. No one even questions it because it's a shot from 6 yards that's been flashed, absolutely smashed at him. If it doesn't hit him, no one blames him. The only reason that anyone's even thought about blaming him is the fact that it's trickled over the line.
I'm going to end it on Edison.
Yeah.
Because he's my number one now. I'm going to put that out there. And it's strange that I'm saying it after he's played against Newport County. But I just watched that game and thought he is so confident. And a lot of keepers are confident. Of course they are. We see Alisson playing out from the back all the time, but Leno seems very confident in his ability. But to me, there seems like there's something within Edison that is just uber confident. And we've seen overconfidence, shall we say, from Alisson with the error against Leicester this season, from Jordan Pickford in the Merseyside derby, thinking he could catch it, potentially with Martin Dubravka, similarly thinking he could catch that when other people suggested that he might have punched it, obviously not you. But Edison just seems to have this absolute unwavering belief in his own ability.
I fully agree, and I think now there's a certain aura around him, and actually what you're seeing is it's almost flipped. And you sometimes see this, and I give this advice to a lot of goalkeepers. Let's say, for instance, I use the example of a cross that comes in early on that you think, oh, I might have been able to come for that, but you don't. Then what happens? They start delivering every cross on you because they realise, do you know, he hasn't come. Whereas if you come and catch that cross, like first cross, 6 yards out, you take it, then all of a sudden you'll just see that all the corners start getting delivered 12 yards out. And they don't even try and put it near you because they know you're going to come and gobble it up. The same thing has happened with Edison, where it was the case that they used to close him down. You watch now, strikers and the opposition are very wary the fact that if they go and do it, they've got a player out of position. And because Man City and Edison are so good, they're just going to tear through you. How many times have you seen it where Edison gets the ball, he looks so chilled, then all of a sudden he'll deliver a 40-yard pass and City are on the counter-attack, and they're so quick when they go forward. So it's almost a case of don't close him down. Basically, what then happens is they all sit off and Edison still has the ability to damage you. So it's, you know, you can't win either way. Whether you close him down and try and nick the ball off him, he'll then thread it through to someone. Or if you sit back, he's still finding the pass. So no, I fully agree. And I think that he's now becoming probably the biggest role model for a lot of young goalkeepers coming through to have that balance of real positivity in your play and that confidence without being lax, without overly taking risks that you may have seen Edison in the past do, whereas now his decision-making seems to be spot on.
And funnily enough, he was closed down by two Newport players in the game at the weekend, and he did miscue a pass out from the back. Look, the pitch played a part. It hit him on the shin, but he miscued a pass. 9 keepers out of 10 would then panic and try and rush into a clearance or foul the player. He just casually just was like, yeah, I got this. The ball ballooned up in the air and he just casually slid in and passed out to Fernandinho and away they went. And that, for me, that was when I was like, wow, this guy, different level.
And that comes down to confidence. And just touching on confidence, you can see it with him. And I know, I think we've made a comment before on the fact that you look at him and he looks like he's just rolled out of bed half the time. It's so funny. You know, he just looks so relaxed in his play. And I think this is another point for goalkeepers to think about. What is the best possible state for you to play a game of football? Now, for a goalkeeper, you're seeing it more and more that actually being a calming influence for having the utmost confidence in your ability is often the best possible state that a goalkeeper can be in. And I think when you watch Edison, you just don't ever feel nervous when you watch him. You know, there's certain goalkeepers that you can think of that you watch. You're always a little bit on edge. You think there's an error there. You know, how that's a classic cliche. Oh, he's got an error in him. But there are certain goalkeepers you watch and you think at some point they're going to do something rash. They're going to make a mistake. With Edison, and that also applies not only to your own team, they'll feel really confident looking back knowing they've got Edison in goal, but also the opposition. It goes back to what I said previously, that they suddenly won't close him down anymore. They won't put crosses in on him, and it actually makes his game even easier because they give him so much respect.
Well, that's it for another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Remember, if you want to get in touch with us, it's very easy to do so on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official. Just search GK Union on Facebook or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. We'll see you next time.